from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court is here. Ronald George has spoken out in recent months about California's dysfunctional government, how the initiative system and the ease of amending the state constitution may be making California harder to govern. We'll talk with him about the court's evaluation of ballot measures and how state budget cuts are affecting the administration of justice, along with other issues like cameras in the courtrooms, California's system of foster care and juvenile justice, and the High Court's landmark ruling on gay marriage. A conversation with the Chief Justice of California's Supreme Court. We'll get started on Forum right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, our guest is the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. Ronald George joined the court in 1991, appointed to the job by then Governor Pete Wilson. And in 1996, the governor elevated him to Chief Justice. And under his leadership, the court has dealt with major legal questions regarding gender discrimination, teenage abortion and parental consent, criminal justice, gay marriage, and many other issues. A couple of months ago, he gave a talk in Cambridge, Massachusetts, warning that California's initiative system was rendering the state ungovernable. Ron George is with us this morning to talk about that and much more. Welcome to Forum. Good to have you here.
Well, great to be back again, Scott.
Well, you know, originally this hour was going to be about food, and you were going to be here in the 9 o'clock hour, and we made some quick changes. So I feel compelled to ask you a food question, which is it's a little bit tenuous. But you gave a speech that I just alluded to in Cambridge earlier this year. And you alluded to, and I'm reading from the speech here, chickens gained valuable rights in California on the same day that gay men and lesbians lost them. You're referring to Prop 8 passing. And in that speech, you did talk about the state and the initiative system being dysfunctional. How so? How do you see it being dysfunctional here in California?
Well, let me start out by saying I think I had good reason to comment on that. It might seem outside my province, but the judicial branch, the operation of our justice system has been very much impacted by the dysfunctionality of state government in terms of resources. So I thought it was appropriate to speak out. And I think it makes it very difficult under our current system, at least in bad times, to raise the revenues that are necessary for various functions of state government, including the operation of the judicial branch. And if there isn't the revenue, then severe cuts come. And for instance, our judicial branch, and as Chief Justice of the state of California, in addition to running the Supreme Court, I'm responsible through the Judicial Council for a budget of $4 billion, and about $450 million of that had to be cut, causing us to close courts one day a month. So I think that's an illustration of dysfunctionality.
Is that, in your mind, the main dysfunctionality, the ability to sort of manage the money?
Well, that's part of it. Another part is that it's very difficult for legislators to do their job when the voters are putting matters on the ballot that require that certain things be done, that certain expenditures be made, and yet at the same time deny the ability to pass a budget, for example, except by a two-thirds vote, or to raise taxes except by a two-thirds vote. And once you have something in an initiative, it's almost impossible for the legislature to change it unless there is permission granted in the initiative. You otherwise require yet another initiative to do that.
And, you know, I was looking this morning. There's another, I think, 50 ballot measures being circulated for signatures right now. Many of them will end up or could end up on the November ballot in 2010. And you undoubtedly are hit up, like we all are, for signatures. Do you ever sign those?
No, I never could or would, because as a judge, I have to stay clear of any measure that I might have to pass judgment on. And being on the Supreme Court, most of the initiative measures end up coming before the court. They're challenged either before they get on the ballot or afterwards. And
That's just routine.
That's routine. And frankly, that's another problem with our process, that so many of them are very unclearly or conflictingly written so that the intent of the voters is not always clear. And often many lawsuits over a period of many years are required before we can make sense of what was actually intended. So that makes it difficult as well.
And there's a frustration on the part of voters sometimes, too, that something that gets passed ends up getting invalidated, or part of it does. Do other states have a different kind of system whereby, I mean, the Attorney General does review these in terms of the ballot summary and those kinds of things, but do they ever get tossed out before they make it to the ballot for some of the reasons you're describing?
There is one provision in our state constitution that potentially keeps measures off the ballot, and that is if they involve more than one subject. It's called a single subject rule, because it would not be fair to the voter to have two unrelated matters put before him or her and then have to say, well, do I hate part A more than I love part B, and having to log roll decide basically what you go for. So that's not allowed. And once in a while, the court is put in the difficult position, certainly in terms of public understanding, saying this measure cannot go before the voters as it's presently worded.
How much concern is there on the part of your court about the will of the voters? In other words, the courts don't want to be seen as being activist judges, to use a phrase, but overturning the will of the people. Do you give considerable deference to that?
Oh, yes. And our case law indicates that if it's at all possible to carry out the voters' will, we consider ourselves obliged to do so. I will say, though, and the public does not always understand this, that the predominant consideration always has to be whether a measure is unconstitutional. So when you talk about thwarting the people's will, actually the ultimate expression of the people's will is what they put into their California Constitution and their United States Constitution. So if a proposal to enact a statutory initiative measure runs afoul of the state constitution, we must, as judges, apply our obligation to uphold the people's will as they've expressed it in the Constitution and invalidate the measure. And naturally, people not trained in the law perhaps have a difficult time with that concept, but it's part of our basic civics, the way our system operates.
But that doesn't happen. It happens very rarely, doesn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. Thinking back, I think it was the 60s, and I may be misremembering the details, but I believe it was the Rumsford Act, where the legislature outlawed discrimination in housing in California. This was in the early 60s. And then a ballot measure was put on the ballot to get rid of that. Basically, it was probably a referendum to get rid of that law, and it passed, and then it was invalidated. So how does that work into what you're saying about upholding the will of the people, but also, you know, protecting the Constitution?
Well, the California voters overruled a decision of the California Supreme Court and, in effect, enacted a measure that said it was all right to engage in racial discrimination in renting out your property. And the California Supreme Court, on the basis of the United States Constitution, held that that was an invalid initiative. Since it was based on the federal Constitution, there was authority to take the case up to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court upheld what the California Supreme Court did. So that's an illustration of that.
And so the original ruling was in the California Supreme Court throwing out that initiative.
Yes. Yeah. And then the voters attempted to override that California Supreme Court decision by changing the law by way of initiative. But that initiative, in the opinion of both the California Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court, ran afoul of the United States Constitution and therefore was invalidated.
You know, there are many people, and there's a pretty active discussion going on right now in the state about the initiative system. People feel that it's out of control, that it's too easy to get things onto the ballot, that it's too easy to amend the state constitution. And you yourself pointed out in that speech and elsewhere that California's constitution has been amended over 500 times, I think.
As compared, by the way, to 17 times for the United States Supreme Court, or rather United States Constitution, not counting the 10 measures that are the Bill of Rights that passed right after the Constitution.
And, of course, amending the U.S. Constitution requires approval by, is it two-thirds of the states?
Three-quarters
of the states, yeah. So, and there are other aspects of the initiative system that people have complained about. And I'm wondering if you've looked at other states, because I think California is by far the most liberal in the sense of getting things on the ballot and also protecting it once it passes so that the legislature can't change it. There's no sunset clause. The legislature can't unilaterally terminate something that's been passed by the voters. What are your thoughts about that?
California, among the roughly two dozen states that has an initiative process, is the most extreme. And as you point out, Scott, it is easier to amend the Constitution in California than any place else. To enact a statutory law by way of initiative takes only 5% of the voters who last voted in a gubernatorial election. To amend the Constitution takes only 8%. Likewise, you were permitted to pay people to acquire signatures, and often you have college kids, you know, going around malls, getting a dollar a signature, and if it gets closer to the deadline, I understand it may be $2 or $3 a signature. So I'm a firm believer in protecting the people's right to enact laws by initiative, but some have suggested that perhaps that 5% and 8% number of voters should be raised to something more substantial. And also that perhaps you shouldn't be able to have bounty hunters. If people really want to get something enacted into law, they should have to be doing it out of motivation other than just, you know, earning some spare change.
Although if you both raise the bar to require more signatures and then rule out the paid signature gatherers, you'd have to really extend the amount of time, because in a state so big, you'd really – it's almost now impossible to get the signatures you need without hiring somebody.
That's true. That would be
– maybe that would be a good thing. I don't know.
That might be a good thing. And another thing, too, is in virtually every state except California that has the initiative process, as you suggested – you can change an initiative. Sometimes there's something that just didn't work out right, there changed circumstances or whatever. In California, it's pretty much locked in concrete once it's passed. Unless the initiative says we reserve power in the legislature to change it, you can't change it. In many other states, the legislature can change it either after a certain period of time has gone by or perhaps by a more than 50% margin. Or,
and then some states have an automatic sunset, I think.
So that's
that
correct.
Laws, you know, automatically end after a certain period of time so you can review them and the legislature can make changes or terminate the law,
exactly.
I guess, altogether. Ronald George is our guest this hour on Forum. He is the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. And I appreciate your being here today. I see you've got your cough drops in front of you. You had a little bit of laryngitis last week.
That's right, but I'm glad I have sufficient voice to chat with you today.
All right. Well, if the questions get too tough, you can always say you can't talk anymore.
I won't dodge it that way.
Well, good, because here's a question that I want to talk to you a little bit about gay marriage. And I know you're limited to a certain extent about what you can discuss, because there is a case now in the federal courts challenging Proposition 8. And you never know in California when an issue is going to come back around and you'll have to deal with it again. But I just want to go back to that 2008 ruling, the 4-3 ruling that you wrote. Talk about the evolution of that ruling and how you came to that point.
Well, one of the seminal cases really in California in this whole area is a case called Perez v. Sharp, which involved California in the 1940s being the very first American state to strike down laws against interracial marriage, laws that prohibited interracial marriage. And I believe it was 19 years before the United States Supreme Court came to the same conclusion. And many years after the California Supreme Court, before other state Supreme Courts, some of them came to similar decisions. And building upon the legal principles in terms of the right of marriage being a right to form a family association with a person of one's choice, the court made that step by a 4-3 margin. And of course, it was controversial, but it was something that those of us who signed on to the majority felt was compelled by our prior jurisprudence.
Was that an evolution for you? I mean, you didn't how did you come to that? I mean, culturally, there's been a lot of change in the way people view not only racial equality, but gender equality and now sexual orientation. It's a process. It's still evolving. How did that evolution happen with you?
Well, it was interesting. Some of your listeners may not know this, but other than death penalty cases, our California Supreme Court decides which cases it will take up. So once we put a halt to the marriages that were being performed without any court ruling having declared the marriage statutes unconstitutional, and the city of San Francisco went to court, a trial judge then ruled that the limitation to opposite sex members was unconstitutional. That went up to the Court of Appeal 2-1, reversing the trial court. So all of us on the court, without having, I think, predetermined thoughts necessarily, and I know I didn't, felt it was an important enough case. It was that important that the highest court of the state had to settle it. And I had absolutely no idea how I would come out when I voted, as we all seven did, to grant the case. So the evolution of my thinking, if one wants to call it that in terms of your question, came about through researching the law and being helped by the dozens and dozens of briefs filed by parties and interested groups and coming to a decision as to what the law was and is today.
You know, I think from the outside, people often think that judges have their minds made up. Especially if there's a political angle to the case in front of them. And perhaps the most extreme example is the Bush v. Gore case in the U.S. Supreme Court. But you're saying that that you approached it in an open-minded way, which, of course, judges are supposed to do. But in that process, what do you find to be the most persuasive things? Is it the briefs, or is it the conversations you have with staff attorneys or other judges or people you know on the outside?
Well, I can say clearly it's not people on the outside, and we're not permitted to do that, although groups can file briefs as amicus curiae or friend of the court. But it's basically what the record indicates, the factual record that comes to us in the form of a transcript, a transcription of everything that was said and put in by way of evidence, and the legal principles that are set forth in the briefs. And then we do our own independent research, and we do a tremendous amount of interchange among the seven justices. You just wouldn't believe the amount of paper that goes back and forth, and we conference on it. And so often a decision ends up being a product, although authored by one justice for a majority of the court, ends up being a product of many, many justices working with our very, very able staff to come to a resolution to try to cover all the principles involved and possible exceptions, because our function is basically to provide guidance to the lower courts, to the legal profession, and to the public.
And you can choose a ruling to be narrow or broad. And the reputation generally of the court, I think, in California is to be as narrow as you can be. If you may disagree with that, but that's my impression.
We try not to engage in unnecessary verbiage that covers situations not posed by the case. But on the other hand, if we rule so narrowly that it only affects Jones versus Smith, then we're not performing our basic function of providing guidance to the lower courts so that they will know, once a slightly different case comes up, how they should apply our precedent. Because we can only issue about 110 to 120 opinions a year, which I don't apologize for. It's about double what the U.S. Supreme Court does with two more justices. But we cannot take up every case possible. The courts of appeal decide most cases. They come down with about 15,000 or 16,000 opinions a year, and we can only, as I say, write about 110 opinions a year.
But in the case of the gay marriage ruling, it was not a narrow opinion. It was a fairly broad one in the sense that it created a higher level of scrutiny for laws that discriminate against people based on sexual orientation. That was obviously deliberate, but I mean, was that a difficult part of getting the 4-person majority, or what was that process, and why did you decide that way?
Well, I think that was an integral issue in terms of resolving the final step, and actually, I think many observers think that was the key to the whole case. Once one came to the decision that discrimination based upon sexual orientation should be treated the same way as discrimination based on race or religion, that then the natural consequence was to say that there was not adequate justification for differentiating and terms of who could marry and who could not. And I will say that all the other rights of marriage in California have been conferred by the legislature with the governor's approval and signing legislation to gay couples. So the question was whether there was a sufficient basis for differentiating in terms of the terminology of what you call that relationship.
And in fact, that was the opponents of gay marriage made that case in the oral arguments. You mentioned the marriages that were happening and which triggered this whole thing back in 2004 at City Hall just across the street from your office. And there was whatever you want to call it, pandemonium, celebration, protest happening during those weeks in 2004. Did you ever look out the window and, you know, look at what was going on? And I mean, did that lead to certain kinds of, you know, reflection and introspection on your part that may have formed, helped you form where you ultimately came down?
I don't think that the constant demonstrations, which, by the way, in Civic Center Plaza covered just about every possible subject, had any bearing on how any member of the court ruled in his or her final vote. But I think it just emphasized that these were real issues that affected real people and were not merely legal abstractions the way some things can be in terms of which statute of limitations applies in this kind of contract dispute or whatever. These were issues with great social ramifications. But that is true of a great number of the rulings that our high court engages in.
You have handled thousands of cases in the time you've been on the Supreme Court. How does that one rank in terms of the weight you felt in writing that decision and in shepherding that through the process?
Well, it certainly was one of the top two or three in terms of cases that I thought had a practical and social, you know, significance to the people of the state of California.
Yeah. And you are, I believe, up for confirmation next year?
That's correct.
2010. That happens every 12 years. Every
12 years.
And I think two of your colleagues, two of the associate justices, maybe Ming Chin and Carol Corrigan also, or Carlos
actually,
Moreno.
Carlos Moreno, yeah. Yes.
How does that ever play into, you think, even subconsciously, the thinking in how to rule? Because as you know, of course, the Byrd Court back in the 70s was largely recalled after a number of rulings on the death penalty, overturning the death penalty.
That's something that long ago I made it clear in my own mind that I would never let influence me, because I think any time that would be a factor, it's time for a judge to hang up his or her robe. When I was sworn in as a young judge, having just turned 32, this crusty presiding judge of the Los Angeles Municipal Court said, "Ron, let me tell you something. Every time you make a ruling, you will make one temporary friend and one permanent enemy. And now I've told you that. Now forget it. You do the right thing." And that's what we all have to do. And I think the public does not always understand that, unlike people in the executive branch or in the legislative branch, we are not supposed to follow the popular will. In fact, it would be totally wrong if a judge put his or her finger in the air and said, "Well, what would be most popular, or what are people thinking of? How is it reflected in the polls?" Your obligation is to uphold the law, whether that's popular or not. You don't cater to special interests or to majority rule. And that's your obligation. And once you make up your mind to do that, you're okay with it, I think.
Much more with Ronald George, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, in the half hour ahead. You can join the conversation by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And you can now leave questions and comments on our website as well. It's kqed.org/forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning, and my guest this hour is Ronald George, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. If you'd like to ask him a question, now's your chance. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. And, of course, you can email us as well. It's forum@kqed.org. Here's a question, Chief, from Kathleen, who writes, "In terms of California's death penalty system, few of any of the reforms recommended by the California Commission of the Administration of Justice have been effectively carried out. yet to continue doing nothing hardly seems a tenable option for the future. Does the Chief Justice foresee that the weight of the massive dysfunctionality of California's death penalty system will eventually beg the constitutional invalidation by the courts? I know that you in the past have said that the leading cause of death on death row is old age.
Yes, I have said that, and it is literally true. The very last part of your question, Kathleen, I cannot respond to because that involves what, you know, the court I sit on could ultimately rule. But your word dysfunctionality is one that I have used not only in describing the overall financial condition of the state, but in terms of the application of the death penalty in California. I firmly believe that whether we have a death penalty or not is a matter for the people of the state to decide. But one can legitimately argue that it doesn't make sense to have 690 people on death row today, and we've had only 13 executions since 1977. And it is a costly system. Those who want to speed it up do not favor spending the money that would be required to attract lawyers to handle these cases. Sometimes it's 2 or 3 years before we can get a lawyer to handle the case. There are many other delays. I've put forth proposals endorsed by my colleagues on the California Supreme Court to permit the California Supreme Court to transfer death penalty cases from the 7 of us to have our 105 Court of Appeal justices handle some of those cases as well with some safeguards. And I personally favor that, but we have not had favorable action on that from the legislature.
Is the chief bottleneck, as you see it, that just the lack of representation, or is it the automatic appeals, or is it the whole system really?
It's the whole system.
I mean, you wouldn't want it to be too fast either.
No, you don't want to do what you do in Texas where they turn them out like hotcakes either. We give very careful review in the state. We appoint lawyers who, through a background check and writing samples and their reputation in the community, we've determined have the qualifications to represent somebody under sentence of death. But by the same token, the system is just totally dysfunctional in the sense that these cases drag on typically a couple dozen years. And it's my own feeling that if you have a death penalty, you should be able to know in, let's say, about 5 years. I don't favor strict time limits, but you should know within 5 years it's a valid judgment, the court's upholding it, it gets carried out, or it's invalid, send it back for a new trial, or if the prosecutor wants to plea bargain and go for life without parole, fine. But don't have it drag on two dozen decades. That just makes the whole system look bad.
Yeah. You said a couple times this hour, you've said, you know, I can't speak to that because it may come before me. Do you ever feel that your own rights are abridged because you can't speak out on so many issues?
Oh, I do. I often say that when it comes to First Amendment rights, judges are second-class citizens.
Well, let's see. We'll try to get some more information out of you this hour on the things you can talk about. Let's go to the phones now. Wynn is on the line in Menlo Park. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. With the system we've cobbled together between the legislature and the initiative process, it looks like the only way we're ever going to get out of this problem is to have a constitutional convention. But yet I've heard that there is no general process for how we would do that and who would be put onto the commission. Can you say anything about the process that might go through?
Well, the outlines for the calling of a constitutional convention are somewhat sketchy as set forth in the state constitution. At this point, only the legislature can call one, but there are proposals to amend the Constitution to allow a constitutional convention to be called by initiative. One of the other great uncertainties is, of course, who would serve as a delegate, and you could have legislators and other individuals. How the process would go in terms of selecting the delegates is uncertain. And then one of the big open questions is this, and I can't express myself as having any views on this. Scholars are divided as to whether or not you could limit the subject matter of a constitutional convention. So it might be that people want to have a constitutional convention to, let's say, restructure the state's fiscal operations, and yet you could end up having social activists with various causes, you name it, putting their agenda items onto the convention floor and not being able to curtail that. So some people are wary about that. And that's why some people think maybe a more modest approach with raising the number of signatures required to get an initiative on the ballot, prohibiting paying people for signatures might be the more cautious one. And I don't have a personal opinion. I'm just throwing that out for you.
And there are, in fact, a couple of ballot measures that are now being circulated for signatures. Two of them, as you said, to have the people be allowed to call a constitutional convention, and then a second ballot measure to actually call the constitutional convention. And the backers of that say that that's the most efficient way to deal with a lot of the problems in the current system and the dysfunctionality that you referred to in the speech you gave. How would if there were a constitutional convention, presumably it wouldn't throw out the existing constitution, it would just amend it. That's my understanding anyway. But what's your understanding, and how would a constitutional convention affect, you know, the courts and precedents and that kind of thing?
Well, actually, a constitutional convention could very well come up with an entirely new constitution. California's had only two constitutional conventions in its history. One was in 1849 when California, in the Gold Rush days, was organizing to become a state. And then the other one was 1877-78, I believe. And that's our current constitution. It could affect the operations of the judicial branch if wording were different from our current constitution. It could wipe out judicial precedents too. That's something that a court would have to determine once there were a constitutional convention.
Boy, the initiative system alone is sort of a full employment act for judges in California, isn't it?
It certainly is. It certainly is, and some of them have come up repeatedly. It hasn't been the case always that when something would come up, it was one case that would resolve it. Some of them have come up on different occasions.
Well, in fact, one of those, and you're very familiar with the issue, is parental notification on abortion. You were part of a ruling on that, and two or three or four times it's been on the ballot, and once again they're circulating signatures to get that before the voters. So I guess they don't take no for an answer. And of course, feelings do evolve about issues too as time goes by. Let's go back to the phones. Peter is on the line in Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity. You were discussing discrimination before, and I wanted to raise the general problem of economic discrimination before the law. And specifically, what can be done to provide guaranteed legal representation to the poor in civil cases the way it is already, at least nominally, in criminal cases? Could a class action be brought? Would legislation be better? Any other comments would be deeply appreciated.
Thanks for the call.
Well, you put your finger on what I sometimes, when asked, described as the greatest challenge facing our court system in the coming decade, and that is the fact that although in criminal matters under the Constitution, everyone has the right to have counsel provided at government expense, that right does not exist, with very rare exceptions, in civil matters. And as a person responsible for the statewide administration of justice, I've engaged in a number of efforts through the Judicial Council, which is the statewide body provided under our state constitution for the administration of justice, in our administrative office of the courts, to try to take some steps to deal with that. We have self-help centers around the state to help people help themselves handling their cases. Between 80 and 90% of the family law cases are handled by people with no attorneys in some parts of the state. We also have an award-winning self-help website, which people can consult and which gives them a lot of assistance. We encourage pro bono efforts, lawyers to devote their own services free of charge. And now I'm very excited that after having pushed something for a few years, it now passed this a few months ago and will go into effect a couple years from now. It's Assembly Bill 590 by Mike Feuer, Assemblyman Mike Feuer. He's the author and gets a lot of credit for pushing this, and I backed it and I lobbied the governor for it as well. And he signed it into law, even though it's a terrible year for any new programs. And it's this. It's called a Civil Gideon program after the Gideon case, which provided counsel at no expense by U.S. Supreme Court ruling. It provides as a pilot project $11 million a year starting in a couple of years to provide counsel in crucial areas where the absence of counsel would make it impossible for somebody to vindicate their economic or family rights. And this is a very exciting concept. It's been endorsed by the American Bar Association, but California is the very first state to have this kind of provision. So we'll have to see how that pilot project works.
What are you hoping that that will accomplish?
Well, I'm hopeful that it will show that with relatively minimal amounts of funding, it can really make a difference in terms of how people's rights are vindicated in landlord-tenant and family law areas, and that may get expanded.
Yeah. All right. Ronald George is our guest this hour, the Chief Justice of California's Supreme Court, with still a touch of laryngitis, I guess, in his throat, so bear with him there. Our phone call, if you'd like to ask the Chief a question, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. KQED also has on our website now. You can leave questions and comments. It's kqed.org/forum. Here's an email from Robert in Oakley, California. Chief, he writes, I'd like to know if your guest would agree that Proposition 13 was a disaster for public funding of essential services, especially of schools in California, and that Prop 13 initiated a precipitous decline in the ability of California to maintain its once superior public infrastructure.
Well, I have to be somewhat limited in my response there just because, as Scott has pointed out, I really am a second-class citizen when it comes to voicing opinions because I can't comment on political questions. But there's no doubt that historically Proposition 13 in the modern era was really the beginning of the use, some might argue, overuse of the initiative process, and that it had a very negative impact, I think, on the quality of education, at least insofar as we don't come up with other revenue. There's no such thing as a free lunch. So if we want to curtail property taxes, and I understand what happened when Prop 13 passed. There were all sorts of elderly folks who had saved up for a home for their retirement. Their taxes were increasing by leaps and bounds. And they were losing their homes. But then we need other sources of revenue to keep the basic functions of government going. And I think that's what people have to understand. There is no such thing as a free lunch. We either have to cut back on services or find additional sources of revenue.
And, of course, there was also at that time, California, Jerry Brown was the governor, and there was also a huge surplus of money. I think $4 billion the state had put in its treasury. And I think there was a sort of a frustration that the state legislature didn't refund some of that money, and sort of a warning to officials that, you know, people will take matters into their own hands in the state if they see something like that that they want to have corrected. Here's a question from Ella, who writes, what was your most controversial decision and why did you rule that way? I think we may have talked about it.
We probably did talk about that in the sense of the gay marriage case. But, you know, every case is important to the litigants. And judges have to bear that in mind, whether they're trial judges or appellate judges. Most people don't get to court often. And what may seem to be a more routine case can have great ramifications for a lot of people. So I think it's a wonderful opportunity to be a judge, to be called upon to exercise that responsibility, and keep in mind that there's no such thing as an unimportant case, especially once it reaches the California Supreme Court. We exercise our discretion whether to take up a case based upon whether it has significance statewide and whether there's a conflict in the law. And even though it may not have the high visibility of something with big social issues, it has great ramifications almost always to the personal lives of individuals and to the business community and to employee groups.
When you issued that first gay marriage ruling in 2008, what effect did that have on your, or did it have any effect on friendships and people you knew? I mean, I imagine some of your friends might have been surprised, no matter how you had ruled, but what effect did it have? Did you hear from people?
Oh, I did hear from people, and I received probably hundreds of pieces of correspondence, most from people I didn't know, but some whom I did know. People were eager to know how the case would come out after it had been argued, before it was decided. And, of course, I had to tell people I knew that it was totally improper for a judge to discuss a case under submission. I think that a lot of people, once they actually read the opinion and understood the reasoning as opposed to the bottom line, had a much better understanding whether they ended up totally agreeing with it or not. And I think that's what's so important about the role of the media, to explain how and why judges arrive at their rulings, whether it's a judge sitting by himself or herself in a trial court, or a three-judge court of appeal, or a seven-justice Supreme Court like ours. Judges don't just engage in a thumbs-up, thumbs-down effort or look at the political ebb and flow. They analyze the law. There are reasons. There are precedents that guide them. And once you take the trouble to read an opinion of the court, and they're all available online, then you can form your own opinion whether or not the court put forth adequate reasons for the decision that it arrived at.
All right. Back to the phones now. Natasha is on the line in Oakland. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Natasha Minsker. I'm the Death Penalty Policy Director for the ACLU of Northern California. Chief Justice, as you note, death penalty cases take an enormous amount of resources from your court and the trial courts. A recent poll showed that Californians prefer life without parole with restitution and work. And my question is, if the voters actually choose to replace the death penalty, what would be the practical impact on your court and the judicial system generally?
Well, a very major part of the function of the California Supreme Court is handling death penalty appeals. As you know yourself, but most listeners may not, the California Supreme Court decides by meeting every Wednesday which cases on its petition conference it will take up, with one exception, and that is the death penalty cases. Those come up automatically because the death penalty is involved. That's what our state constitution requires. And they leapfrog over the Court of Appeal and consume, I'd say, between 25% and 30% of our workload. So if those cases were not coming before us, either because the people of the state of California decided to abolish the death penalty, or those death penalty cases could be transferred in part to the California Courts of Appeal, the California Supreme Court would have much more time and resources available to undertake its basic function, which is to resolve conflicts in the law and to decide other important questions of criminal law and civil law.
So do I understand you correctly? A quarter to almost a third of your time is spent on death penalty cases.
Yes, and they're very long transcripts, typically 10,000 pages of transcript, some of them almost approaching 100,000 pages.
It's crazy.
And it takes a lot of effort and is a major part of our responsibility.
Yeah.
Not that we've chosen it. That's what the Constitution requires us to do.
Hmm. Here's a question from a listener, George in Alameda, basically a term limits question. Isn't 12 years long enough for anyone to be a Supreme Court justice? These are lifetime appointments subject to voter approval, right?
Well, what happens is that once one is appointed under the California system by the governor, the appointment is finalized only when the Commission on Judicial Appointments confirms that. And then the person runs for the rest of the 12-year term. When the 12-year term is over with, he or she is on the ballot again for a yes or no vote. That's the way the people of the state of California have drawn up their system. Some states have different approaches where people run against each other on a political partisan ticket, which has not worked well. They do that in Ohio and Texas, for instance.
I think Sandra Day O'Connor is leading the charge to get rid of that system. I think the United States is the only country in the world that that has a system like that in any state.
That's correct. There are some states where a justice can only be up for a fixed term, whether it's 12 years or 14 years or whatever. In California, you can re-up, and the voters have to approve it. So that's something that we don't decide ourselves. I think you'd lose a lot of expertise if somebody had to leave after 12 years. You could have somebody appointed in their 40s or early 50s who is quite capable of applying the expertise and experience into another term. But that, again, is a matter for the voters to decide in terms of how our Constitution is providing.
866-733-6786 is the number to call if you'd like to ask the Chief Justice of California's Supreme Court, Ronald George, a question. Let's go now to Jessica in Los Angeles. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I work at a nonprofit think tank called the Center for Governmental Studies, and we study ballot initiatives, and I was wondering if the Chief Justice thinks there's any legal issues in terms of the calling of a constitutional convention, allowing the people to by initiative call that convention.
That question came up earlier. We did talk about it, and I suspect you can't talk about it because it may well come before you, but what can you say?
Well, I can say this, that people have of course, pointed out that presently only the legislature can call a constitutional convention. And some have said, well, we can put an initiative measure on the ballot to change the Constitution so that the people can call a constitutional convention. There are some who question that procedure, and I can't weigh in on it, first and foremost, because that's an issue that could come before us if that happens and it passes. And it's improper under the code of conduct for a judge to comment on a pending issue that may come before him or her. But secondly, even if I didn't have that constraint, it's a very complex question that really has to be researched, and I don't have an opinion.
All right, Jessica, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Gary in Castro Valley. He writes, I completely agree that California's current initiative process hamstrings state government. I'm interested in your views on how you believe the voters' right to make law can be reined in and still get the voters' support. By the way, I don't agree that initiative proponents should be prohibited from paying signature gatherers. By gathering signatures, college students aren't always looking for pocket change, but instead are working for actual food money while paying outrageous fees for room and board at UC and CSUs. And then the final question, a law prohibiting payment of signature gatherers probably would be unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution, wouldn't it?
Okay. I mentioned a couple of things that have been suggested, and you note them without endorsing them. I'm just because people sometimes say, well, what are there by way of proposals and what can you do other than having a constitutional convention? And you point out that there may be issues, both legal and practical, why it's not a good idea to make those changes. I will say with respect to the number of signatures that there are about two dozen states that have an initiative process, and most of them have a higher percentage. They virtually all have a higher percentage of signatures that have to be acquired in order to put something on the ballot, or do provide some way that the legislature can, after a period of time or under certain circumstances, alter something. We are unique in really putting our government in a straitjacket through the initiative process. So again, without endorsing anything in particular, I point out that those are ways that we can look at the process, and while protecting the people's right to the initiative process, perhaps streamline it where it will not render our government as dysfunctional as I believe it has been rendered.
I want to ask you a question about cameras in the courtroom. You, on occasion, have allowed cameras into the courtroom. The gay marriage case was one example of that. And there's now a move perhaps to allow cameras into the federal courts, in that case on Prop 8 that's making its way, and the trial begins next month, in fact. What are your thoughts about cameras in the courtroom? Good idea on a limited basis, or what do you think?
I think it's an excellent idea. to permit cameras in the courtroom with appropriate safeguards. There's the California rules of court about which I think there's general agreement. They operate well in the state, Rule 980 and following rules that provide that with certain guidelines, cameras can be allowed in by a trial judge in his or her discretion. I will say that our California Supreme Court grants virtually every request to televise oral arguments. And not only do we do so on our regular calendars, but I'm proud to say that we engage in an outreach effort and have one of our sessions every year in an outlying community where we bring in high school students. We get thousands of them in our courtroom, and thousands more see the arguments televised into their local high school classrooms with a lawyer or judge in attendance as a mentor. And it's a giant civics lesson. It's a way of expanding electronically the walls of the courtroom and the walls of the classroom, because I just think people are not getting a sufficient idea of how and why courts make rulings, and that it's very beneficial to have more sunshine into the process and have people understand how courts operate.
Just about a half a minute left, but the oral arguments for the gay marriage case were televised. How did you feel about that? What effect do you think that had?
We had a lot of feedback saying that people really understood, whether they agreed or disagreed with the ruling, how the court was going about its process, probing the issues, trying to come to a just resolution.
Do you think the justices behave differently knowing it's on television?
I really don't think so. I think you really sit back and you get involved in the case, and it does not impact.
All right. Chief Justice Ronald George from the California Supreme Court, thanks so much for being here despite a scratchy throat. I hope you can rest your voice the rest of the day.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it as always, Scott.
All right. Thanks to you. Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer here for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening. And don't forget, you can continue the discussion online at kqed.org/forum. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.